Hi, nice to meet you all. I'm Haerin Cho. As Avery said, I'm a fourth-year graduate student working with Ramesh Narayan. I worked first on like analytical stuff in my first 2 years of grad school, but now I changed to GRMHD simulations. And today I'll be talking about this project where we try to bridge scales from event horizon scales to galactic scales. I will mostly talking about the paper that I published in FJ Letters. And if I have time, I will also like talk about other things that I've been doing after that first letter. My advisor is Ramesh Narayan, and I also work with Priya, Natarajan at Yale, Ben Prather at LANL, Kung Isu and Angelo Ricardo from Black Hole Initiative, and Kaushik Chatterjee, who was at Black Hole Initiative, but now in Maryland. So to set the stage, we know from observations that black hole properties and galaxies properties are correlated with each other. However, when we think about the spatial scales that are involved between the each for black hole and each for galaxies, they are very different in order of magnitude. So there has to be some kind of a two-way communication happening between the very small scales and very large scales in order to explain such coevolution. And in simulations, there has been two tools available to us to study this black hole, how black hole and the galaxy talk to each other. The first type of simulations is galaxy simulations with Newtonian gravity. Here, it's a good tool to use if you're interested in complicated galactic scale physics, such as self-gravitation, star formation, stellar feedback, and complicated gas dynamics, such as bars or spirals. However, the resolution near the black hole is very poor, so you would have to use a subgrid prescription for accretion and feedback. Note that the best resolution is usually around 10 parsecs, and translating that to gravitational radius units where we're more comfortable with, for M87's case, that corresponds to 3 × 10⁴ RG. And the other type of simulations is GRMHD simulations, where it's usually computationally more expensive, so it usually only converges from the event horizon scales to 100 RG. Here, because we have very high resolution around the black hole and we can we have general relativity inside, the accretion and feedback is self-consistently simulated. However, as I said, it's very computationally expensive, so we would have to use idealized initial conditions and boundary conditions, which are often far from the realistic galaxy environment that the black hole is embedded in. Also, feel free to interrupt me anytime. So these two types of simulations, note that the scales that each simulation cover have very little or no overlap at all. So it has been theoretically challenging for us to understand how small scale, close to the black hole information can talk to the large scale galactic scales. So then we can ask this question of why are we not doing just a huge simulation that goes from event horizon scales to like galactic scales in just one simulation? In order to like describe the difficulty, I have multiple scales that I'm showing. So in the very center, there is a black hole, usually around a few gravitational radius. And then there is a Bondi radius where black hole's gravity and sounds, black hole's free fall velocity is around sonic velocity, sound crossing velocity, that's around 2 × 10⁵ RG. And the large galactic scales, say a megaparsec, would translate to 3 × 10⁹ RG. The time step of the simulation would be determined by the smallest length scale by current conditions, usually around a few gravitational radius. However, the total runtime of the simulation would be determined by the length scale that we want the convergence up to. So if we assume that we run this huge simulation for a very long time until we reach a convergence up to the Bondi radius. That's going to take me more than 15 years to complete. And this is assuming that I have no interruptions at all in my computational time and I have full access to 4 GPUs. Okay, so,
By convergence, you mean reaching some sort of a steady state?
Yes, yes. Reaching a steady state across from the event horizon to Bondi radius, yeah. Okay, so this is why we're not doing a huge simulations. However, there has been some attempts previously to bridge these very disparate scales, and I've categorized them into three different categories. So the first one would be a resimulation method, where basically, since you can't do the whole simulation from event horizon to galactic scales, it would start off from a large-scale simulation. So you can see in the x-axis, the green line is extending from 1,000 RG to 10 to the 7 RG. So that simulation would be done first. After that's evolved for some time, the inner part of that large-scale simulation would be used to initialize the intermediate-scale simulation, which is in blue. And then after running that for some time, this would be repeated again to initialize the GRMHC simulations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all through here, you're stressing that you're going to define any kind of dynamics. This is because the ability to define fields of connect very non-local areas. And if you throw away the magnetic part, you throw away the path patterns in some sense. You're throwing away the main physical effect of things played out.
Yes. I think it is quite important, which I will illustrate later. So I have ran simulations with and without magnetic fields, or also maybe weak fields. And if you have a very strong field, that's really qualitatively changes all the accretion and feedback stories. Yeah.
In the case of Shawn's simulation, mm-hmm. magnetic fields is actually, it's coming from the
stars.
So that's what's feeding the magnetic field into the center black hole. So in that case, it's connected from the outer part to the inner part.
Yeah. So this is the first type of method that has been used to bridge these galactic scales to event horizon scales. And the second method is a Lagrangian hyper-refinement method. This is very similar to the. Yep.
Are you looking into radiatively inefficient accretion or are you looking at efficient or does it make a difference?
Yeah, we are focusing on radiatively inefficient case, but similar. I know that other groups are also looking into a radiatively efficient case as well. But here in our project, we focused on radiatively inefficient case. Yeah, and the second method is Lagrangian hyper-refinement method, which is very similar to the first method, but only difference would be working in Lagrangian framework. So instead of a grid-based simulation, you would have particles, gas particles, and as it comes closer to the black hole, it will refine its mass to a smaller gas particle mass. So this is very similar to a resimulation method where it's as it comes closer to the black hole, it's refining itself. The third method is basically just running GRMHC simulation for a very, very, very long time. As I illustrated before, this is not very feasible to do if you have a very large scale separation from the black hole horizon to galactic scales. So their approach was basically reducing the Bondi radius from a realistic value of 2 times 10 to the 5 to 1,000. So simulating a smaller analog of a realistic galaxy. And yeah, that's the third attempt they have done.
They do that changing the equation of state of the gas, or how they reduce the Bondi?
Yeah. So the Bondi radius is determined by the ambient gas temperature at large radius. And if you have a hotter ambient gas, that means that your Bondi radius is going to shrink.
Right.
So that's how they control their Bondi radius, yeah.
But they also change properties of the black hole or not too much?
When they're reducing the Bondi radius?
Right, so yeah, so artificially in the sense that starting with Bondi radius that is feasible, but then that would also change the properties of the gas near the black hole, right? It's not, I guess I'm asking, is it scalable, you know, or you see there is, do you think there is a problem by doing that, or?
I think, well, okay, so this is also something that I've looked into after the first letter, like what's the dependence of the Bondi radius? Like if we change the Bondi radius, what changes and what doesn't change? So I will get to this like after, if we have time. But the bottom line is, I think it will have an effect on the accretion rate. Yes, yeah. So there, these were the previous attempts before our work, and they were, especially for the first two methods, they were very successful at tracking the inflow from galactic scales to event horizon scales. However, they were not able to track, by design, it was very hard for them to track the outflow coming from the event horizon scales to galactic scales, which is the other important ingredient in understanding the coevolution. The third case, they're able to track inflow and outflow self-consistently. However, they were not able to track this inflow and outflow using a realistic scale separation. In order to solve this issue, we came up with this method that we call multi-zone method, specifically for hot accretion flows case or radiative inefficient flows. And we use a GRMHD code called Karma to do it. And the idea is that, imagine we have a huge spherical grid going from event horizon scales to, let's say, 10 to the 8 RG. Then instead of trying to simulate the whole thing at once, we would divide them up into annuli or zones. And that way, we're not limited by the small, very small time scales near the black hole. So here,
I have different annuli. I imagine that there is a local delta T, and then the smallest one would be in the one associated region closest to the black hole. And that would move the day, right? Because they can go very far out or for a long time far out, but eventually need to wait for everything to catch up. So, how is it that you might find something?
How am I able to reach the convergence?
This way, you're not bounded by the small delta T associated with the black hole, but I don't, how is that you bypass that?
Right, so, yeah. So I think the reason behind trying to split them into annulus is because, okay, so here each colors represent each zones. So the y-axis is showing the radial in logarithmic scale. So this purple one would be the smallest annulus near the black hole. And the radius going from 1 to maybe 64, like the radii at 64 doesn't need that much, like compared to the radius of 10 to the 8, I guess what I'm trying to say is the convergence will happen much faster in the inner part compared to the outer part. So the outer part doesn't need to be, like, it needs to be evolved for a much, much longer time to converge. So what we're trying to achieve by splitting up into different annulus is trying to achieve converged or steady state at each range of radii.
So maybe,
if that makes sense.
Maybe a way to sharpen the question. Do you evolve all of these annuli simultaneously, or do you just evolve the outermost radius by outermost annuli first, and then once that's reached some sort of steady state, you then evolve the next outermost and work your way in?
Yeah, I think it's gonna be helpful if I go through the explanation, because what we're trying to do is we're repeating this. I'll explain first if that's okay. So yes, we divided them up into different annulus, and what we're doing basically is the first half of this process is very similar to the resimulation method. So we simulate the outermost zone first, and then after running that for of certain fraction of that characteristic time at that radius, we switch on to the next zone. So the idea is to have one active zone at a time to be simulated, and everywhere else would be frozen. And to answer that question that you had, we're not running each zone for a full duration of their dynamical time, but we're actually keeping that very short. So we're, for example, I'm running the yellow zone for 2% of the dynamical time there and switch off to the orange zone and run it for 2% of that dynamical time. So this would be repeated until it reaches the black hole, the purple zone over there. How, and here's where the difference comes. We do this process of sliding this active zone back out. And that's the part where it's by design helping to track the outflow direction as well. And since we're only running each zone for 2% of the time, 2% of the dynamical time, we repeat this V cycle not only once, but multiple times until we reach a statistical to steady state over a wide dynamic range. This is exactly like demonstrating what I just said. This is radius in logarithmic units, and black two circles are indicating where the current active zone is. So you might notice that the simulation is being run when only when they're in between those black circles, and otherwise the other parts of the simulation is staying fixed. Did that answer your question? So we're not trying to reach, so whenever we're in that zone, we're not trying to reach steady state at that duration of the run, but the idea is that by running each zones for a short amount of time and switching them and repeating this process for multiple times, we want to achieve a smooth communication between scales.
So for the boundaries, are you just fixing it at this level?
So for the boundary conditions, what we're doing is, for example, that yellow zone, I would keep a fixed Dirichlet boundary condition at 10 to the 6 and to 10 to the 8, and for that duration. And then you might notice that there's a significant overlap between the neighboring zones. So what was previously a boundary, a Dirichlet boundary, would be in the next largest zone, would be in the middle of the simulation. So that would let free and be involved. But there will be another Dirichlet boundary conditions from, let's say, I guess that's more 10 to the 6, but yeah, in the inner and outer radius. The reason why we're switching so fast, like 2% of the dynamical time, is because we want to reduce that effect of that Dirichlet boundary condition that we set. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. And I have one more question. So do you expect there to be a actual stationary solution in which you could reduce this problem to an actual lifting problem and solve it with multi-grid, or because it's turbulent or something like that, you don't expect it to actually be perfectly stationary using something like an average?
We think that there will be a steady state in the time average sense. So when we actually look at the time evolution of all the quantities, they fluctuate over time because, except for the hydro case, but when we add strong magnetic fields, it's very highly turbulent. So every quantity fluctuates over time. However, it fluctuates over a constant value. So in a time average sense, we think we find a steady state. And we can tell if something is in steady state if we do the time average over this part of the last simulation and this comparing the other time averaged quantities. And when they match, so initially it would fluctuate from the initial conditions. However, at the later times, all these time average will look the same. And that's when we say it's found a steady state.
So, Marina, getting a lot of questions on process and code details, I imagine that some of these you'll address. And so in that instance, just say, hold on, get to that in a slide. And maybe we should let Erin get through her presentation and what she's doing before we harangue her about all the details, which we can do at the end, of course.
Okay. Sounds good. And I know it's you might be worried about this method, so I also have some tests that I can present, which we were very convinced about. So yeah, that will be coming. So so using this method, we first wanted to test it out for a simplest case possible, which is a purely hydrodynamic Bondi accretion. In this case, we don't have black hole spin or no rotation of gas. This problem is really good because we can compare our numerical results to relativistic analytic solution. So here I'm showing on the left panel the density as a function of radius, where the Bondi radius is at around 2 times 10 to the 5, shown in vertical line. And the red line is showing the result of the numerical simulation. And the gray band is showing the analytical solutions. And you can see that they perfectly overlap with each other with a characteristic density slope of r to the minus 3/2 inside the Bondi radius. On the right is showing a feedback efficiency parameter. This is the quantity that we will be interested in eventually. But here we can also compute this for hydrodynamic case. The dotted line, so if it's a positive value, it means there is energy coming out from the black hole to the galactic scales. And if it's a negative value, it means there's no feedback and only energy is being evicted from galactic scales to event horizon scales. You can see that they're both dotted lines, both analytic solutions and numerical solutions, agreeing in the sign and also the magnitude, which is around 10 to the minus 5 of accreted rest mass energy. And when we calculate the amount of thermal energy that is available, this actually corresponds to this number. So thermal energy is getting evicted onto the black hole in purely hydrodynamic case.
So this is a 3D simulation?
This is a 3D simulation, yes. But since we're not adding rotation of the gas, it's basically a 2D problem where everything's infalling radially.
Bondi
accretion, yes.
But I guess the thing that's weird is you would think that even a tiny bit of angular momentum basically would add up as you get close to the center.
Yeah, so this was a really interesting test. It means that even if we run in 3D, this code can preserve no angular momentum.
Okay.
Given the very large scale separation, it was able to do that. This problem was a simpler problem because, as I said, in purely hydrodynamic case, only the information is coming from large scales to inner scales, and there's no reaction from the black hole to the galactic scales. So the real challenge would be when we add strong magnetic fields onto the same problem, where the system will become highly turbulent, and there will be outflow along with inflow. And our method is designed to capture both directions. So that would be, a more interesting simulation. So we added strong vertical magnetic fields onto the same problem and see how it evolved. And here I'm showing a snapshot of that simulation. It's going from the smallest zone. To the largest zone in this direction. And you can look at the scale bar in the left corner to take a look at what each panel's scales are involved. The left half of each panel is showing the plasma beta parameter, which is just a gas pressure to magnetic pressure ratio. And the right half of each simulation is showing the density with magnetic fields overplotted. You immediately see some hints of outflow. So for example, this panel over here, you see a blob of gas being ejected out, which originally started from very small scales near the black hole. And this amount of outflow is of scale of Bondi radius. So our method was able to capture this outflow. Oh, okay, great. This is interesting. Okay. Thank you. And as I said, when we add strong magnetic fields, it's becoming highly turbulent, so we can take a look at what the time evolution of the accretion rate is like. So the black line is showing the accretion rate as a function of time, where the accretion rate is in units of the Bondi accretion rate, and the time is in units of the free fall time scale at the Bondi radius. So you can see that after a few TB, like it does fluctuate over time, but it fluctuates fluctuates around a constant value. And that value of the accretion rate fluctuates around is around 5 × 10⁻³ of Bondi accretion rate. So this indicates when we add strong magnetic fields, the accretion rate is not following Bondi accretion rate anymore, but it's suppressed to 5 × 10⁻³. This is consistent with M87 stars and Sagittarius A stars observations. So that was really interesting to find. And for those of you interested in magnetic flux, dimensionless magnetic flux parameter, it also is shown in blue. So it's also fluctuating around a constant value of around 30. We can repeat the same analysis as before, trying to look at time averaged and time and shell averaged quantities. So the new line, the new addition additional lines are black lines, which is in MHD's case. So you can see that when we added strong magnetic fields, the density slope has changed from r⁻³½ to r⁻¹, which is again more consistent with observations of how the accretion flows. And the feedback efficiency parameter now changed its sign to a positive value, meaning that when we add, when we have a strong magnetic field to start with, there is feedback. That amount of feedback was around 1% of accreted rest mass energy. And we were, when we first saw this, we were quite surprised to find feedback because we didn't include black hole spin or gas rotation. So black hole spin is supposed to give you relativistic jets, and that's going to give you feedback. And angular velocity of the gas is supposed to give you disk wind, which is going to, again, contribute to feedback. So here, even if you didn't have both of them, we still found a mild amount of feedback. And here, we in this paper, we were saying that we report a minimum amount of feedback that's possible from black hole. Okay, so.
So this tendency, like r⁻¹, is kind of expected for this inflow outflow solutions, right? These ADOS models and that sort of stuff. When you have like convection, for instance, or that sort of processes producing winds. And maybe you mentioned, but what is exactly can you repeat what is exactly the feedback? What is producing the?
What's producing the feedback?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we did go into a little bit of depth in the paper, and yeah, we wanted to quantify what's causing this feedback. So the analysis that we did in the paper was we can. So this feedback efficiency parameter is computed using the stress energy tensor. And then we can divide that stress energy tensor into magnetic components only versus hydrodynamic quantities. And in the hydrodynamic, and what we found there was it was mostly coming from hydrodynamic part. And this was confusing us because only when we add strong magnetic fields, we were seeing this feedback, but magnetic fields don't seem to be playing a part in carrying the energy out. So then we computed out of the hydrodynamic quantities, we can divide them up into two again. So we could divide them up in, I think I actually have a slide, extra slide on it, which I hid, but oh, I can't show you. Yeah, so we can divide the feedback efficiency into the fluid part into advection and convection part, where the advection part would be basically looking at the laminar part of the flow, and convection part would be looking at the turbulent part of the flow. And there we found that the convection part completely dominates. So from this analysis, we think this very mild kind of feedback that we're seeing is caused by reconnection to start with, those magnetic reconnection to start with. But the actual energy is carried out by the gas blobs, which is highly, which is heated by the reconnection events close to the black hole. Yeah.
So the question is, I guess that originally there were this idea of CDAP versus ADAP. Is that what it is? Convection dominated flow?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting point because the density scaling that we find is different from CDAF. So CDAF density scaling is r to the minus 1/2. So we were finding something different. And we are currently trying to understand what, I'm currently trying to understand what's the difference between CDAF and what we are finding here. But there has been a recent paper by Sue from CCA, who's proposing this new accretion model called SCAF. It's a simple convective accretion flow, where he is proposing with his convective dominated accretion flow, he's finding r to the minus 0.8, which is very close to r to the minus 1. So I'd like to understand more like how that model compares to my simulations. But yes.
But yours is r to the minus 3/2. Right.
But only for hydro case. But MHC case, I am finding r to the minus 1. Yes. Okay. And I think then I have time for other things that I did after the paper. So as I alluded before, we carried out this test to first reassure ourselves that multi-zone method is okay, because we know that introducing Dirichlet boundary conditions, it could cause some differences from compared to when we're doing normal GRMHC simulations. So what we did here was, again, we were, instead of trying to do a realistic scale separation, we can take the third method where we're reducing the Bondi radius and creating a smaller size. If we do that, we can then run that simulation in one zone completely, like a normal GRMHD simulations, without any introducing any boundaries. And then we can compare that one zone run with the four zone results to see how they're different. So this is what we did. And I think the red and orange is not as interesting because we've initialized with a very weak magnetic field. So it's going to basically follow the Bondi accretion flows case, which are shown here. They're always overlapping with the gray band, which is the Bondi accretion. But more interesting was when we add strong magnetic fields, will our multi-zone method be able to reproduce our one-zone simulation results? So here I'm showing the accretion rate as a function of radius in units of Bondi accretion rate, the density as a function of radius, temperature as a function of radius, radial velocity as a function of radius, plasma beta as a function of radius, and feedback efficiency as a function of radius. And the one-zone results are shown in black, and our four-zone results are shown in blue. And it was surprisingly very similar. Like the accretion rate agrees with each other. The density slope also agrees with each other. All the quantities seem to be similar to, the four zone results seem to be reproducing one zone results very well. Of course, you can see some kind of artifacts showing here. For example, efficiency parameter is a very sensitive value, so you can see some artifacts coming from the Dirichlet boundary conditions. However, we think that the most important conclusions that we can draw out from this multi-zone simulations are not are still consistent. So we can still trust the time average accretion rate, the efficiency parameter, the feedback efficiency parameter, and the radial scaling. I think those conclusions that we can draw out from the multi-zone simulations are still valid.
Sorry, can I ask a question? So here, place where you do see a difference, maybe you're saying that's too small. But so there are other knobs in your approach, right? So one of them is the time of evolution, almost 10% of the dynamic time. So have you looked at how sensitive it is to that choice?
Yeah. So actually, I didn't get into detail why we chose the 2%, but there was a reason. And yes, we also looked into if I change that to 1% or 4%, how it changes. And we found that it's not that sensitive around that value. We haven't tested an extreme case, though. We haven't tested, oh, what if we change it to maybe 10% or like 50% or maybe like 0.1%. That extreme cases we haven't explored. But around 0.5% or 4%, like it didn't really change the results that much. One thing that we're trying to look into, though, is what if we actually go into that extreme regime where we're basically switching zones every time step. So one cycle, we switch to next. One cycle, we switch to next. Then that would be an approximation to the real smooth communication without like a strong effect on the boundary. This is something that we are trying to look into as well. It's just a technical bookkeeping that we need to solve, but yeah.
Can I ask a question about impact of the boundary conditions? So you mentioned you see in the efficiency some impact of the boundary conditions. It seems very natural to me because if reconnection is responsible for dumping your energy, then you're gonna have weird artifacts when you hold one place fixed and one is right. So a couple of immediate questions then lead to mine. One would be, is the time to reaching stationarity the same with your one zone or your multi-zone, or do you have to go up and down the scale many, many, many times more when you've broken it up?
Yeah, so this is something that was a little bit tricky to compare between one zone and four zone, because one zone, at all radius, they would be run at the same measurement of time, while in four zones, all the different zones would run for a different amount of time. So it was, I think the reason why we did this experiment is to see what's the best way to compare one zone and four zone, at which time. Because this weak field results of this weak field magnetic plasma beta parameter, this is actually a function of time. So as we run it for longer and longer, this will only decrease and decrease. So this was a good test to see at what criterion we should stop this four-zone simulation to compare to one-zone simulation. And that's what we did. And yes, from this test, we could tell at what time we could stop the simulation and compare it with the one zone. And yes, that time actually corresponded to we needed to do a lot of iterations from up and down multiple times. I think one of the simulation results that we presented, it was over 250 cycles of V. 250 V cycles.
Okay, so that's not terrible, right? 2% times 250 is still only five.
Yeah.
Times everywhere. But so that raises a second question, which is, what would the right boundary conditions be? As is always the case, boundary conditions are critical. So. The outer boundary conditions, I could totally believe you would just freeze in the simulation at that scale. But the inner boundary conditions, given the much shorter dynamical time, you might imagine should be some sort of average or some sort of dynamical thing over its face. So do you make any attempt to explore that? Or?
Yeah. So this was actually the idea that we talked about when we first thought about this project. We completely agree. Like the idea that the reason behind that is because for smaller scales, when you compare smaller scales to larger scales, to smaller scales, outer larger radii would seem frozen, right? they wouldn't evolve that much. So to inner scale properties, they would seem frozen. So that makes sense. But as you said, for larger scale and properties, the smaller scale would be always evolving inside the black hole. So technically, we also thought averaging, having an average quantity as our inner boundary condition would be ideal. But there has been some technical difficulties, such as magnetic fields are very sensitive. And since we're using constrained transport, it wasn't very straightforward to how to do that, like without creating divergence of the magnetic fields. So as a first go, this is the approach that we've chosen. In other words, we would just, even though it may not be the perfect thing to do, we would just freeze at one snapshot of the simulation, and we would make up for it by doing this V cycle many times. So in a time average sense, and when we time average them, that would be a representative inner boundary conditions. So yeah, that brings up a point. This method, because of the design choices that we made, we wouldn't trust the variability or statistical properties that's coming out from the simulations. What we are focusing on using this method is time average. What is the time average steady state? And yeah, this all has to do with our choices that we made. Yeah.
So if you tried something silly like launching a sound wave from the black hole and making sure you capture it throughout the whole domain?
I think we briefly talked about something like this before, but no, we haven't done the test. I think that would be an interesting test to do, actually. Yeah. Okay. So this slide was just to reassure that our multi-zone method seems to be okay in the sense for the quantities that we're interested in. And I'm not sure if you want to save time for questions or if I can go on.
We're asking questions as we go.
Okay, sounds good. All right, so the next thing that we tried after this letter was, since we're going from the event horizon scales to galactic scales, we know that it's not only just black holes' gravity that's having an influence. Outside of the Bondi radius, dark matter, stars, or gas starts to have a gravitational influence. So we, if we really want to connect to larger scales, and eventually we want to like put it in a realistic galactic framework, we knew that we needed some kind of external gravity that we had to include. So we modified our Kerschel metric such that it's incorporating the contribution from those galactic sources of gravity. So this phi g over here is a new addition in our metric. So when that's zero, it's just a normal Kerschel metric in the Schwarzschild black hole's case. And that phi g is taking into account, there is a postdoc who's running galaxy simulations using Gizmo, and I could take the enclosed mass profile from that simulation to calculate this external gravity term, gravitational potential, and I could put that in our metric. And using that galaxy simulations, we could also change our initial conditions outside of the Bondi radius. So this is showing what the new initial conditions I'm using in blue from the Gizmo simulations. And this is density as a function of time, density as a function of radius, and temperature as a function of radius. And you can see that instead of the Bondi analytic solution where outside the Bondi radius is a flat profile, now we have a density slope that's coming from the galaxy simulations. So this was the initial conditions, and when we run the simulation using this metric, the red line is the final output, and you can see that instead of flattening out like a Bondi's accretion solution, it actually maintains its slope, meaning that the external gravity is having an effect, and it's helping to maintain this initial slope that it started with. And this was a purely hydrodynamic case. And again, we first always start with hydrodynamic case and then add strong magnetic fields onto the same problem. So now we have run a simulation with magnetic fields information coming from the gizmo simulation. So here I'm showing beta as a function of radius and the initial conditions as blue. And that magnetic field information, instead of an artificial vertical field, now we're using the full magnetic field information coming from galaxy simulations. And on top of that, we've also added the 3D velocity information from Gizmo. So now we have some amount of mild rotation going on, so 10% of the Keplerian velocity. And then when we run this simulation, the results are shown in black. So density, again, still finds r to the minus 1 slope. And instead of maintaining its initial slope to start with, interestingly, that has flattened out the density outside of the Bondi radius a little bit. And we think that's caused by black hole feedback coming from black hole feedback coming from small scales. Temperature just finds the Bondi accretions solution, even though it started off with a flat temperature profile. The plasma beta parameter finds a plateau around the phi before falling into before having a decreased value near the black hole. And it still finds a few percent of efficiency, which is consistent with the Bondi accretion simulations.
So question. I guess I could have asked for the previous parts as well. So your accretion rate, is that constant or is that something that depends on radius?
Oh, accretion rate as a function of radius? So this was a very difficult thing to include, because what accretion rate would do is it was constant over from horizon to maybe I can't remember, but around 100 to 1000, but then it started showing weird behavior. And we think that's because of so much outflow and inflow happening at the same time. It's just really hard to get a flat profile. And we noticed that the previous works that has also done this large scale separation simulations, they also didn't show accretion rate. So here, in this paper, we described that we think it's a quantity that's...
Because it doesn't make sense to not show it faster.
Yeah. But here we're showing the feedback efficiency, which is nice and flat. So I think this is an indication that it is reaching the convergence over wide dynamic range.
So the eta is converging, but m dot is not.
M dot has a hard time.
Converging.
I think I have a plot actually.
Does that mean the power output also is having a hard time, so that you have pretty good efficiency?
Power output?
Isn't eta, your power output divided by m dot?
Oh, yes. So when we, so this parameter we actually use for the denominator, we just take the accretion rate at 10, just assuming that's the actual value. Yeah, I think we chose 10 just because to avoid the effects from numerical floors, which I think it's pretty common to do. Here I'm showing the accretion rate. This is a plot plot from the paper. So accretion rate, the total accretion rate starts to suffer beyond 100 RG. And we also plotted what the inward flow versus outward flow is. So inward flow is in solid line, blue line, and the outflow rate is in cyan line. So they seem to be the total accretion rate would be just a difference between these very large values. And I think we think that it was the reason why it's suffering is because it's a difference between very large values.
So accretion, so you're referring to mass flux, like the total mass flux, right? When you say accretion rate, it's just the mass flux, right? Because I say accretion rate, I imagine just inflows.
Right? Oh.
But if you're referring to total flux.
Yeah, I'm referring to the total flux. And ideally, what you should find is like a constant value.
Yeah.
And the accretion rate near the black hole would be basically just the inflow rate. Because as you can see, the outflow rate just drops significantly closer to the black hole. So, yeah.
So it kind of looks like that when you're far from the horizon, then you basically have a random walk of some sort. Then on average, there's like, actually, on average, there must be accretion because you have accretion in this.
Yeah.
If you're far out, it's just randomly.
Yeah. So
the random part is much bigger than the systematic part.
Yeah, so that's, I think that that's what's happening, and that's why it's so difficult to get a flat profile as we,
Based on that, could you make an estimate for how long you'd have to run in order to be able to resolve the average? I mean, it's just pretty flat inside of like 30M. Like, if you want to get out to 100M, would you have to increase your run time by an order of magnitude? Have you tried that?
I have run very long simulations using this method, but we didn't really see it improving that much. It would always fall around the around here.
Did you increase the averaging window when you ran the long simulation? Right, because that's really the thing. If there's a stochastic component, you need more realizations of it to average it.
Yeah.
Right. So
yeah.
It is averaging window size.
So the averaging window, I'm just basically choosing the last half of the simulation for average. So when I run it for a longer time, it should be choosing a longer window. But I don't think I've tried making more realizations, like providing putting out a more number of outputs and see if that helps, maybe. But I'm not sure. Yeah.
And just to be clear, these are still zero angular momentum initial flows onto a non-spinning black hole.
This is just a Bondi MHD,
right.
Without the realistic angular velocity.
So do you have what happens if you put in?
Yeah, so this was the result. So when we initialize with Gizmo's case, we initialize with around 10% of the Keplerian angular velocity, and surprisingly, it didn't really have an effect. And looking at the time evolution of this angular velocity, the reason why we're not seeing a huge effect is because we are seeing some sign flips of the angular velocity, even though we started off with a single sign of angular velocity. So this is currently what we're looking into. And when we first saw that the sign is flipping, the angular velocity sign is flipping, we were suspecting maybe multi-zone method is causing this. Maybe multi-zone cannot handle angular velocity's case. So we tried a test to see, is that really true? Like, is multi-zone not really able to handle rotation? But comparing the one-zone versus four-zone, it seems like they are consistent with each other in terms of this behavior. And seeing the time evolution of both one zone and four zone simulations, you even see this behavior in one zone. So this is something that we want to, so from this comparison, we don't think this reduce of angular velocity or sign flips of angular velocity is not coming from the multi-zone, but it's something related to our initial conditions, we think, and this is something that we want to like investigate further. So
we're running up closer to the end. So
yeah.
Please,
I can wrap up. Yeah. So please come talk to me if you're interested about dependence of Bondi radius, but I'll wrap up here. So with multi-zone approach, we're now able to track two-way communication between the black hole and the galaxy. And in the simple hydrodynamic case, we find perfect agreement with the Bondi accretion, analytic solutions, and no feedback. When we add strong magnetic fields, the density changes slope to r to the minus 1, and accretion rate is suppressed. Both are consistent with observations, and there is a mild amount of feedback. And right now, we're working towards adding a black hole spin to study what relativistic jets will change the picture, and also trying to use the galaxy simulation as our outermost zone as a part of our multi-zone method. So that's to come. So thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you, Erin. So I think a lot of questions got asked during the seminar. Do we have a question from somebody who did not ask a question during the seminar? Shakufa, please.
Just what is small black hole? You have advection from equal and optimal and forms and convection of all tetons, right?
Sorry.
You have convection for all tetons.
Yeah.
And advection just at forms, equal and optimal, right? Inward and outward related
energy. Convection at all theta and advection happens near the midplane. Well, I guess what you'd mean by advection. Advection of energy inwards happens near the midplane.
And outward.
Outward in the poles, yes. So we did also take a look at the theta dependence in here, which I didn't get to, but yes, that's what was happening. Convection would happen at all theta, value of theta.
All right. Yes, go ahead.
So this dependence of rho going density going to 1 over r seems so simple. There must be a simple explanation for it. You have one? You don't have to be sure that it's the correct one, but there must be at least 5 of them.
I think the SCAF model that I talked about, their main idea of the reason behind r to the minus 1, they say it's going to come from turbulence. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're finding, even in hydrodynamic simulations, when you add turbulence, the density slope changes to r to the minus 1. I think it's their explanation, but I would like to really sit down and understand their theory paper. As of now, I'm not sure if I 100% believe that.
Do we have any other?
Well, so I think maybe we need to get to the slides for impact on this, but this is the ultimate goal here to calculate some feedback rate and then put that into cosmology simulations? Or
yeah.
I can't understand what's happening at the black hole or what?
Yeah, I think what we ultimately want would be because it's cosmology simulations. It's a really, really it's like a one parameter that's controlling the black hole feedback, and they're always not sure what value to put in. And the one of the goals that we had in mind for this project was providing some realistic subgrid prescriptions for cosmology simulations. And it would be very interesting when we add black hole spin, how does that depend on the spin value of the black hole? So yeah, that's definitely one of our goals.
Let me take an organizer's prerogative and ask the last question. And that is, I remember 25 years ago, Jose, I think, Quadra wrote a paper looking at the accretion rate in the galactic center driven by the Wolf-Rayet stars. And what he found was there was no rhyme or reason to it at all. It wasn't going to be some steady outer boundary condition. You would have shocks between stellar winds, which would cause streamers to come down. So that creates kind of the nightmare scenario where at the large scales, we don't have a nice smooth thermal equilibrium gas that we're going to accrete from, and all the structure and the dynamics of the accretion flow are driven by the accretion process, but in fact they're being injected from the outside. And so you are building a tool that can start to answer these kind of large multi-scale structures. And Sean Ressler and company did a very similar thing, as you mentioned early on. But is that going to break some of the assumptions underlying many of these multi-zone type codes or multi-scale codes, which necessarily have to somehow treat large-scale information as constant for small scales? In your case, you're going up and down the cycle many times, so you're making an improvement on just resolving the small scales. But then, you know, won't you be at the mercy of what happens on those larger scales, and you may never have a nice steady state?
Yeah, I think that's a hard question. For Sagittarius Star's case, it is definitely true. Like, it's very stochastic supply of gas, and there might not be, like, the steady state that I found might not be applicable to Sagittarius Star's case. So, yeah, I think that's a good point. But I guess if we want this to be used in cosmology simulations where, in an average sense, they just assuming that most of them have constant supply of gas, I think that then it would be applicable for Sagittarius A star's case. I think it would be, I think our assumptions would break down. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good point.
If you're willing to buy isotropy and homogeneity, this isn't a bridge too far for you. All right. Well, thank you very much. Let's thank her in again.